Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, remembering the Great Flood of 1913. This week marks the 100th anniversary of that event, and today you'll hear from Leon Bay. He's with Gem City Circle Tours, and Friday nights in Dayton, he gives a downtown tour of notable flood landmarks. And later in the program, we'll check in with Bill Felker and Poor Will's Almanac. Up first, the weekend news. The U.S. Department of Defense is delaying unpaid leave notices for its civilian workers, including thousands employed at Ohio's largest military installation, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. The Pentagon said Thursday it's putting off sending the furlough notifications until on or around April 5th. Colonel Cassie Barlow, commander of the 88th Air Base Wing at Wright-Patt, says the delay gives more time for officials to analyze the effects that pending federal funding legislation could have on the Defense Department.
And that delay is going to specifically allow the department to carefully analyze the impact of pending continuing resolution legislation. So we're encouraged that the Department of Defense is continuing to explore every possible way to get us around a furlough. And we're guardedly optimistic about the future.
In an interview with WISO, Congressman Mike Turner shared Colonel Barlow's cautious optimism.
You know, the process in Congress of putting together the funding for this year and for the Department of Defense is ongoing. And the department apparently believes that in this environment that they have an ability to extend the furloughs as they do an assessment of what the real impacts will be of the shortfall of sequestration. I'm certainly hopeful that both the president and congressional leadership will come together in a meaningful way so that we can find a funding source to put this money back and make certain that these people do not have a personal impact from sequestration.
An estimated 13,000 employees at Wright-Patt are expected to be among those furloughed for 22 days as a result of automatic defense budget cuts. The furlough notifications were to be sent out in the next couple of days. Defense officials say the pending legislation could affect the number of furlough days needed if it's signed into law, but they say no decisions have been reached so far. Earlier this week, Governor John Kasich was being quoted as saying he supports the option of civil unions for gay couples, but not same-sex marriage. Now his press secretary says the governor needs an explanation. As State House correspondent Bill Cohen reports, the explanation raises yet another question.
Here's what Governor Kasich told a TV reporter earlier this week. If people want to have civil unions and have some way to transfer their resources, I'm for that. I don't support gay marriage. I just think marriage is between a man and a woman, but if you want to have a civil union, that's fine with me. Now that may sound as if the governor's endorsing a change in Ohio's law or constitution to adopt a legal framework for civil unions for gay couples, something that a state law and a constitutional amendment both currently ban. But the governor's press secretary, Rob Nichols, is saying no. Quote, while he may have used the term civil union loosely in this instance, he recognizes the existing rights of Ohioans to enter into private contracts to manage their personal property and health care issues, end quote. The governor's position is unchanged, Nichols says. In his words, he opposes gay marriage and opposes changing Ohio's constitution to allow for civil unions. Supporters of a proposed new constitutional amendment legalizing gay marriage had already dismissed Kasich's original statement. They'd said civil unions aren't enough of a change, and only full-scale marriage equality is fair. The verbal and written exchanges may not be over. That's because the latest statement from Nichols says the governor is, quote, opposed to discrimination against any Ohioan. That raises a question. Would the governor support a decades-old idea, enlarging the state civil rights law to ban housing, job, and public accommodations discrimination against homosexuals? We've asked the governor's press secretary that question. Nichols' response, we don't take a position on every bill introduced in the General Assembly. But Nichols notes the governor did issue an executive order early in his administration declaring within state government there shall be no job discrimination, including on the basis of sexual orientation. Bill Cohen at the Ohio Public Radio, State House News Bureau.
A newly discovered photograph calling into question the Wright brothers' claim to the first in-flight title has created controversy this week between aviation experts. Some historians say German immigrant Gustav Whitehead deserves the distinction. Dayton aviation photographer and historian Dan Patterson is WISO's aviation commentator. He discussed the issue in an interview with Emily McCord.
There has been a controversy that's surrounding a photograph that was found by an amateur historian. His name is John Brown. And in it, he claims that he's found evidence that the title of first flight should go to a German immigrant named Gustav Whitehead and not the Wright brothers. He claims that he's found a photograph that proves this point. He then gave this photograph to an aviation publication that's well-respected called Jane's All the World's Aircraft, who corroborated that and said, yes, indeed, Gustav Whitehead deserves the mantle of first in flight. To talk to me about it, Dan Patterson, aviation photographer and historian, also WISO's aviation commentator. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
The picture itself was a photograph within a photograph. It was a picture of an exhibition celebrating aviation.
That is correct.
And in the background, there are several photos that are on display, and this is the one that he zoomed in on.
That's correct. I looked up the website, and it's been enlarged about 3,000 times. They've gone through the process of photo analysis, like intelligence experts used to do and still do, and it's just inconclusive. It's as easily could be a cloud formation. It could be anything. The website is a little bit unclear because he claims he's actually found the photograph, but there's no evidence in his website of scanning or looking at the actual photograph. He's looking at something that's behind the flying machine in question. And so it's pretty fuzzy. Fuzzy logic, fuzzy photograph, fuzzy pixels, any way you want to play it. It is in direct contrast to the crystal clear images that the Wright brothers made of their experiments from the point they started through when they flew in France and flew in Europe and came back to the United States, which are razor sharp, crystal clear photographs. If you enlarge the photograph of the Wright brothers' first flight, which is the first flight, you could probably read the make of the heel on Orville's shoe. It's that crisp. These are blobs.
Then John Brown takes this photo to Jane's All the World's Aircraft. That's a really respected publication in the aviation world. And the editor there said, yeah, Gustav Whitehead deserves the mantle. Why would he corroborate that?
That is an extremely good question. Jane's All the World Aircraft is and has been the Bible for aviation stuff for over 100 years. They've been publishing before the Wright brothers flew. And when I was a kid, you know, I couldn't wait till the latest issue got to the library so I could ride my bike down to the library and get the book out and see what was up. And so for them to give this apparent credibility seems to me like an attempt to sell books.
The Smithsonian has come out in defense for the Wright brothers being the first in flight. Their 1903 flyers on display in the National Air and Space Museum. Here's Tom Crouch talking about this matter in Dayton. And he's saying that the claim that Gustav was the first actually raises more questions.
In later years, he continued to build airplanes for other people. Strangely enough, they didn't look like anything like what he claimed to have flown in 1901 and 1902. And even stranger, none of those airplanes that he built for other people in later years ever left the ground. So you're left with what? Did this guy kind of forget the secret of flight or something? Why didn't he continue? If he'd flown that far, why didn't he continue doing it?
So those are some strong words from Tom Crouch of the Smithsonian. Others are saying the Smithsonian needs to protect the Wright Flyer exhibit, and that's why they want to hold on to that mantle of the Wright brothers having the first in flight. What's the story here?
There is no better authority on the globe about the Wright brothers than Tom Crouch. They have the airplane. They have the research. He's done the definitive book about the Wright family. I don't think there's a vested interest. It's a matter of history.
But the whole idea that the Smithsonian may be wanting to protect that exhibition, is that something that holds any water?
Absolutely not. They did not even get the Wright Flyer, 1903 Wright Flyer, until Orville died in 1948. up to then, they were claiming Samuel Langley flew first, that Glenn Curtiss had an issue flying first, that the French flew first. They would not recognize the work of the Wright brothers. Orville worked out an agreement with the Smithsonian before he passed away, and the Wright Flyer came there after that. It is on display. It's in a place of honor, as it should be. It is the first airplane, period.
I'm speaking with Dan Patterson. He's WYSO's aviation commentator. We're talking about the controversy surrounding the first in flight distinction, whether or not the Wright brothers really were the first in flight. Why does this kind of controversy keep coming up? Why do people care so much about this first in flight distinction?
Well, it was a big deal. I mean, the competition for flight 100 years ago, now 110 years ago, was pretty stiff. And Samuel Langley had been given an enormous amount of money by the United States government. And his efforts were described by the Washington Post as it slid into the river like a handful of mortar. It's a pretty good description. The French thought they had flown, but it was much after 1903. And they claimed to have flown under control. But it took them 10 miles to turn an airplane around. When Wilbur went to France and demonstrated the airplane and flew inside the confines of a horse racing track, they realized who had solved the problem. The Wright brothers were first, and everybody admitted it.
Gustav Whitehead, this name has come up before. Even without this photograph, there are other folks out there that have brought this up and said there's other evidence that this is the guy that was the first in flight.
That's true. This kind of a controversy percolates out of the swamp every 8 or 9 years. And there have been claims that Whitehead was first. There were claims, I mean, many of the French felt they were first. There was a guy in New Zealand who felt they were the first. And where's the proof? A fuzzy photograph or questionable eyewitnesses from the time period this guy was operating in Connecticut go in direct contrast to the Wright brothers' very methodical method of research and a photographic record of every step of the way. So it's hard to believe. It's impossible to believe. And those of us here in Dayton, Ohio, should be out in the streets with pitchforks and torches defending the Wright brothers.
I've been speaking with Dan Patterson. He's an aviation photographer, historian, and WYSO's aviation commentator. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Years ago this week, the citizens of Dayton, Ohio and surrounding communities watched in disbelief as collapsing levees allowed floodwaters to overtake the city in a matter of moments. To commemorate the anniversary, WYSO has re-edited its production of The End of Emerald Street, a collaborative work with the Living History Theater. It recounts the dramatic moments leading up to the flood, the devastating effect it had on the residents of Dayton, and highlights the innovation and ideas that would eventually chart a new course for flood control around the world. The End of Emerald Street was written by Kay Reimers and directed by Dan Davis. It combines fictional characters with historic figures like John H. Patterson, Arthur Morgan, and John Berenger. It also features a host of local actors including Howard Shook, Dan Davis, Flo Lorenz, Tony Dallas, and Miriam Eckenrode. Rounding out the audio performance is original music composed by Dayton native Justin Vanderberg. We hope you'll take some time this week to listen to The End of Emerald Street. You'll find it at the top of our homepage online at WYSO.org. Here's a little bit of what you'll hear.
When
when these three storm fronts collide, the rain will last for days, perhaps an entire week. If it does so, there will be a flood of biblical proportions in Dayton.
Biblical proportions.
We're printing the story tomorrow. Front page. Three major rainstorms all coming together right over this town.
The rainfall began slowly and softly that Saturday night. At first, it seemed nothing more than an early spring rain. Yet by Sunday, the rain poured down on the city in sheets.
Oh, Lucy, look at you. You're soaked.
Oh, Carolyn, the water is overflowing in the streets. I tried to call you a few minutes ago. The line was completely dead.
The phone lines are probably down all over Dayton. There is nothing to worry about. Tomorrow is just another day.
How did they get stuck on their roofs?
The creek must have been rising so fast they couldn't get out in time.
That has to be it.
Those people up there must be freezing, sitting on a roof in the rain in March.
Oh, they'll probably be rescued in a few hours. They're going to be pretty miserable until then.
At least we're publishing a flood warning.
There are still people standing on the levees.
It should be obvious to everyone what is happening.
Clearly it is not, Mr. Patterson.
The farm, it's gone. The river just swallowed it up.
The river?
We first heard the horses. Then they knocked down the fence and ran away. I never saw anything like it. Your mother and I went outside to catch them. I turned and there was this wave of water coming from the mad river. It was over our heads.
It was like the river was reaching out to grab us.
I yelled at your mother, run, just run.
A six-foot-high wave thundered into the streets, tossing streetcars into storefront windows, rolling motor cars like dice, and shaking buildings off their foundations.
I'm going down to the corner and see for myself.
No, stay in here. It's dangerous out there.
This is my street. I know it, and I'm not afraid of it. Oh, my God, the water's up to the front steps.
Mama, what's wrong?
Please, just take your sister and go upstairs.
The water is on the porch.
Oh, it can't be, not this quickly.
Yes, it can. It can happen very quickly.
It's coming in under the front door.
That's not possible.
Get upstairs.
We have to leave.
No, it's too late for that now. Go upstairs and calm the children down.
Perhaps he got out, and the canoe went on without him.
Yes. Yes, I'm sure that's what happened.
In that case, they have my permission. Sparks! I see sparks flying over.
I got him! We need some more water over here!
Well, if you see Harold, tell him we are fine. Do not tell him about the house.
If the city wants it, let them have it. Save yourself the fuss.
It's not just this street. Dayton will come back.
I don't care much at this point. When it all happened, you know, I was calm. I was joking. I was sharp. But afterwards, I suddenly find myself weak and shaking like a leaf. I don't like that feeling.
You have lived here all your life. So have I.
They're saying, do not forget the promises made in the attic. Well, I remember my promise. I didn't promise to bring Dayton back.
The end of Emerald Street on 91.3 WYSO.
And to learn more about the Great Flood, I took a trip downtown for a talk with Leon Bay of Gem City Circle Tours. On Friday nights in downtown Dayton, and for the next couple of months, you can join him there to learn more about the flood.
At the top of the courthouse, we had a banner right up there where the triangular part of the architecture is. There was a banner that said, "Remember the promises you made in the attic." It was a huge stretch canvas art piece that John Patterson had commissioned for the top of the courthouse. As far as we know, it has not been saved. And this was the crying, the theme of the entire flood prevention fund. Now, that's the positive part of the flood prevention fund. That was started right here in the last of March. After the flood was over, and it ran through May 25th. And as you see on the marker, it says right here, the peak of the memorial plaque indicates the high water level at the crest of the Great Dayton Flood of March 25th, 1913, and also commemorates an important episode in the history of Montgomery County here on Sunday night, May 25th, exactly 2 months after the flood. Just 2 months later, over 30,000 citizens gathered right in front of this courthouse in the Miami Valley, and they celebrated the completion of the raising of $2 million for a flood prevention fund. And in this wonderful photograph I have, it talks about the flood prevention fund. And it says, I am a policyholder in the flood prevention fund. And then it says, for the love of Dayton. Here's the big sign. It says flood prevention fund. And we know for a fact that 23,000 people climbed the steps to the courthouse right here, went up to the tables that were up here, and donated their pennies, their nickels, dimes, quarters, dollar bills. Now, people say, well, what did they do with $2 million? Did they build the dams? Absolutely not. That's where everybody's confused. The $2 million was spent to bring the best minds in the country into Dayton. Arthur Morgan, the man of the hour, the man of the century, in fact, for Dayton. And he brought over 50 civil engineers with him. And they pondered how they would design a series of dams if they got the okay to proceed. But the $2 million paid for the mines to lay out a series of dams. Now, they didn't have the luxury of making a mistake on this. They had to do it right the first time. And these guys got it right the first time. And today, we have all the dams that protect the Miami Valley. So this marker is just terrific because it celebrates not only the awful flood, but I tell people, the flood was awful. Let's forget about that. Let's talk about how we had the vision to move forward and to get the best minds to come to Dayton. Did you know Dayton was one of the few cities in the United States that ever did anything like this? And it was all privately done. No government money. People say, oh, it was all government money. No government money. And then it goes on to talk about how the Conservancy came into existence to protect the valley. And it talks about all the great rivers we have here. The Mad River, the Stillwater, the Miami, and then Wolf Creek and Twin Creek. And that's where we get the name Five Rivers, because we have five rivers that come into this particular basin here. Now, you know what the Native Americans said years ago? You don't want to settle here. They said, we got flooded out centuries ago as Native Americans. And the white settlers said, oh, you don't know what you're talking about. We're going to settle right here. Well, it was the biggest mistake, because every 10 years at least after 1795, 1796, guess what happened every 10 years? Had a flood. Now, sometimes it got 1 or 2 feet deep downtown. But old-timers said, well, you know, we can put up with that. We have a few levees. Well, then one day, it started to rain, and there were 5 days of rain. Friday, March 21st, that was Good Friday. And then Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. And every day it rained more and more. And on the first day, on Friday the 21st, it was 60 degrees outside. Wow. The next day it was 22 degrees, which meant the ground froze, and the water all ran off into the rivers. And then, about the third day, it rained 11 inches. Not only in Dayton, the entire Ohio Valley, to Toledo, down to northern Kentucky. And that's when everybody was in trouble, because the drainage from all these rivers converged on Dayton. But then guess what happened down in Middletown and Hamilton and Cincinnati? We know 100 people died in Hamilton from the flood. Now that's amazing. Dayton had over 350 plus that died, probably the biggest. Guess what? Columbus, of all places, it had a flood too. It was the same flood. It wasn't the same rivers, but the same water or rain system got Columbus. So they were in terrible trouble. All the towns north here, terrible trouble too. But they all came to the aid of Dayton. The plus thing is, we didn't have any suburbs back then. There was no Oakwood. There was no Dayton View. It was all right downtown, and this is where it got the worst. Now, there was some high ground. And do you know where that was? The Art Institute? The University of Dayton. It was Easter weekend. All the students were out of the dormitories. They put 600 people up at the University of Dayton. NCR was high ground. 800 people in tents for Tent City for months out there at NCR. There were other places for high ground. The fairgrounds, it was high ground. Part of where Miami Valley Hospital was high ground. The highest, people always want to know highest waters, 20 feet downtown. That's the max. But there were some places where it was 10 feet. We think it was about 12 to 15 feet right here where that marker is. But that meant the entire courthouse right here, the basement got flooded, and guess where all the records were? In the basement. Not too smart, were we? And by Wednesday the 26th, the water had crested at 20 feet downtown and lower in some places, and that's when the gas explosion started. It was horrendous. And there was no way to put the fire out. 65,000 people were displaced, 20,000 homes destroyed, 360-plus people died. Buildings were moved off their foundations and moved everywhere around the city. And people said, how did that house get on our street? That doesn't belong in our street. And many of the houses were sitting out in the middle of the street when the water went down. Property damage, $100 million. And in today's figure, that would be $2 billion. Unbelievable. 1,400 horses died. I may have misquoted that a little earlier. University of Dayton was very instrumental. It was called St. Mary's College back in those days, and it did a lot to help people, too. There were a lot of people who did a lot to help. What's interesting is there is a, I found an old sign that said the people of Tippecanoe City would like to help Dayton. And everybody said, well, that's real nice, but what can you do for us? And they said, we got a streetcar line that runs to Dayton. It's too bad we don't have one today like that. That would be great. I take a streetcar today. So they start the streetcar in Tippecanoe City, and they could run it right down to Dayton because it wasn't washed out down there. And guess what people did? They brought their produce, their baked goods. They brought eggs. They brought salads. They brought any food that they thought that people could have because people were starving to death down here. And they loaded that streetcar every day. They loaded that streetcar really heavy with everything except for one thing. They wouldn't send milk on the streetcar because it was too perishable. If you had cows, you were to bring your milk directly yourself to the city because there were many babies and children who absolutely were desperate for milk, too. So people turned out unbelievably. We probably have never seen people be so generous as they were back then. It's amazing how it brings out the best in people. The worst thing brings out the best thing. Isn't that ironic how it really works? People just went beyond the call of duty. I don't think there was a mean person in town during that time period. Everybody cared about everybody else. And people didn't really realize how dependent they were on each other until something like that happened. But you know what the good news is? We have never had a flood like that since because the visionaries of Dayton made sure that those dams are put in place and they work and they still work. And let's hope that they work for generations to come. So there are lots of great things downtown to celebrate, lots of history, but there's also lots of new things happening downtown. So I hope you all enjoy some of the things I've shared with you.
Leon Bay with Gem City Circle Tours. He offers his Great Dayton Flood Walks at 7 p.m. on Fridays downtown. You'll need a reservation. You can find out more at gemcitycirclewalks.wetpaint.com. Well, this spring is nothing like the one Dayton had 100 years ago. This weekend's forecast calls for snow, not what people have been waiting for. If you can't wait any longer, you may just have to close your eyes and pretend.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the fifth week of early spring. White cabbage butterflies are the surest sign of the beginning of the end of early spring. And once you notice the familiar white cabbage butterfly, then you know the more elusive morning cloak butterflies and the question mark butterflies and the tortoiseshell butterflies and the tiny blues are flying too. When you see cabbage butterflies, then you know that goldfinches are turning gold. And soon you may see ants working on the sidewalk. If you see a cabbage butterfly, then you know that catfish have begun spring feeding and breeding, and then greenbottle flies have hatched and termites are swarming, looking for new sweet wood to eat. When cabbage butterflies are out, then soft sprouts of touch-me-nots have emerged in the wetlands, and the branches of weeping willow trees are turning pale yellow-green as their buds expand. In the city, cornice moss shrubs produce golden blossoms, promising forsythia in the first week of middle spring. If you see a white cabbage butterfly on your way to work, You can know that Middle Springs Hepatica and Twinleaf are pushing out in the sanctuary of the woodlands. Toad Trillium and Dutchman's Breeches are ready to open there, and the entire spectrum of wildflowers is surging to encounter April. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the sixth week of early spring. In the meantime, watch for the first white cabbage butterfly, and then imagine all the rest of spring coming right behind it.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this week's edition of WYSO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.